Okay. Well, welcome to the Marine Interest Group of San Luis Obispo County. Today's July 17, 2008, for those of you that are watching this on tape. We're pleased to have a great program today, some very interesting developments happening in the marine world along the San Luis Obispo coast, and look forward to sharing those results with you and talking about some of the opportunities that are coming forward. My name is Don Maruska. I serve as the independent facilitator for the group. So my job is to help bring out the best from each of our participants and from those that participate from the public, and we welcome everybody. And we're going to begin by just going around and having 1 to 2 minutes of update from individual working committee members of things that you think the public needs to know about or that committee members need to know about. And so how about if we start with you, Deborah?
My name is Deborah Stakes. I'm from Cuesta College. I am building up an oceanography program.
I'm sorry, we're recording this. And
okay.
Needs you
oh, yes.
Oh.
So we have to. By the way, the microphones have a switch on them. Oh, okay. Microphones have a switch on them. Switch them. So you can turn them on, switch them away from you to turn them off.
You forgot to give me the primer again. The microphone primer.
There you go.
Okay, is that fine?
That'll be fine.
Okay.
Speak with clear, dynamic voices.
Great. So once from the top, I'm Deborah Stakes. I'm an instructor at Cuesta College. I am building up an oceanography program. I am hoping that this is a venue for us to provide information to the general public about the basic principles of oceanography. I'm happy to report that the course at on San Luis campus is completely full already, a month from starting classes, and the new course on North County is already half full. We have a lab. We have some great instrumentation in the lab. The lab's going to focus on technical things, and we just recently deployed our brand new CTD water sampler from the Cal Poly Pier, and we're looking for a boat of opportunity with a winch and a boom that we can take our students on a field trip.
Thank you. Good. Mark?
I'm Mark Cognizini. I'm representing Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization tonight. I'm vice president of that organization. Jeremiah's offshore. Oregon, someplace catching albacore as of this morning. We know that. I don't have anything to report, and I'm just here to keep some realism in the whole process.
Great, thank you.
My name is Bob Lavelle. I'm going to be that for
you. Is that on now? Thank you, sorry. My name is Bob Lavelle. I'm here on behalf of EcoSlow. This is my first appearance at one of these meetings, and I'm looking forward to it. It's often discussed at our meetings, but someone else normally covers it, so I'm going to be listening more than I'm going to be probably directly participating. I've been out of the state for several weeks, but I wanted to let everyone know or remind them that Coastal Cleanup, which is sponsored by EcoSlow, is coming up very quickly, and I would ask that everyone keep their eyes open for those dates. Thank you.
My name's Ray Fields. I'm the manager of the Abalone Farm up by Cayucas, and not too much to report at this time. We've been getting a couple good stories in the local paper lately. One was written by AP and was in the Fresno Bee and LA Times, San Diego. And I thought an excellent article in the New Times last week on not so much abalone farming, but the demise of the abalone fishery off our coast. I thought they did a pretty good job. The third round of the MLPA process is starting up, I believe, in October. So we're trying to get on the advisory group for that so we can watch out for our interests there. And that's about it.
My name is PJ Webb. I'm with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. I'm the at-large representative from the southern end of the sanctuary. And I have a really exciting event that's coming up this Saturday, which turns out that pretty much everybody in the entire county has an event coming up this Saturday, so put it on your list of things. It's the second anniversary Coastal Discovery Fair. It'll be at the San Simeon Cove. It's going to be real fun. There's no admission price. There's, if you have kids or if you're just a big kid at heart, there's going to be booths, there's going to be raffles, there's going to be some live animals there, and lots of interesting information about good watershed practices, about ocean health, about wildlife, and it'll just be a really fun time. So this Saturday, July 19th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and if you're seeing this after this date, just go up to the Coastal Discovery Center on the weekends and go see the Coastal Discovery Center. It's a wonderful educational where the coast, the water, and the wildlife meet. Thank you.
You might want to remind people where the Discovery Center is located.
Thank you very much. The Coastal Discovery Center is at William Randolph Hearst State Beach, which is basically the San Simeon Cove where the pier is. So you go to where the entrance to Hearst Castle is, and you make a left turn instead of a right, and go into the cove and park there. And I'll hand out information to people here. Thank you.
Okay, Dave.
Hello. I'm Dave Sears. I'm an at-large representative here tonight. I've been a member for quite a while now. And I have nothing lustrous to report, but I did see something that was very interesting to me on television since our last meeting, and that was about a half-hour TV presentation that included Dan Berman talking to Assemblyman Sam Blakesley about the Morro Bay estuary. And it was very invigorating, and it was fun to see, you know, the influence on the political processes and the just the integrity of Dan, who, too bad he's not here tonight, or he'd be cheering. But that was outstanding. And the other thing that, to me, is so far encouraging is the collaboration between our governor and our two state senators about their feelings about offshore oil. And I'm staying encouraged by that collaborative effort. So stay tuned.
Incidentally, and not so incidentally, the Army Corps of Engineers visited us this last week and informed us that we have significant but not critical damage again to the breakwater to the tune of about $3.5 million. So this is an ongoing effort for us, and we'll get, since it's not critical, we'll get in line behind a lot of other people who have significant projects. So that's all I have to report to you this evening.
Thank you.
I'm Rick Algren. I'm the harbor director for the city of Morro Bay. The dredge Aquina just left the harbor after 21 days of federal maintenance dredging. And, you know, maybe I'll tell you all about a meeting we just had, another long meeting. But I think it's a subject that's worth bringing up here. There's two oyster growers left in the bay, Tamales Bay Oyster Company and the Williams Shellfish, a smaller family operation. The Tamales Bay Oyster Company has been here since 2004, growing in the lease sites toward the east side of the bay. And Tamales Bay is larger production, providing oysters for their retail outlet up in Tamales Bay. And it's been a nice thing to see as their production has increased and see all the oysters taken out on the dock at the commercial fisherman's wharf there just by our office. Unfortunately, this year, because of some additional, well, in part because of the results of some additional voluntary monitoring they'd done, the oysters are regulated by the State Department of Health Services because it's a food product. And as Ray would well know, I'm sure he's under the same very strict regulations because of food products. Their E. coli levels are quite, I don't know, low or high is the word, but anyway, they're quite strict. And they've had some unexplained, difficult to explain, and irregular tests that resulted in closing down a major part of their growing area this year. And normally they do close down when there's winter rains because of the watershed providing materials that just make it so that their product can be sold for consumption for a period during the winter. But some of these tests were again in February, March, April when it wasn't raining. So that has basically resulted in their production stopping. And he's now got, as he told me today, I think it was $600,000 in oysters that they have not been able to harvest and they're sitting on, waiting to go up to their retail outlet. You can imagine what that does to a business. So, and it's very concerning, too, is for the long-term outlook of keeping them in operation. We just had a meeting, and I appreciate Dan pulling it together with an NEP, with Regional Water Board members and Department of Health Services, Department of Fish and Game folks, NEP, other members of folks that would like to see if there's more that we can do to try and help Drew find a way to keep in business and get back to harvesting. And I think that this is something that perhaps we should talk about at the MIG, maybe at your next meeting. And I think that there's some additional monitoring. I hope he's on the edge now. Of course, the tests seem to be getting better. But again, the problem is that it's unexplainable exactly why these tests would cop. A lot of people, you could speculate a lot of reasons, but it's been going on for sort of the last 2 years with these tests out of nowhere that pop up on the E. coli and force production to cease when they shouldn't come up. So it's going to be very, very difficult to run down the cause, but there may be additional monitoring, and which would cost some additional money, that we may be able to do and allow them to get into different areas to grow or somehow change their ways to keep them in business. So thanks.
That's a very interesting topic. There was an article in Monday's Los Angeles Times about the problems with oyster farms up and down the coast, even up into Washington, and some of the challenges they're having. So it may not be only a localized issue here that we're facing, but certainly one that's really important. Thanks for that update.
Yeah, it becomes apparent when you listen to this. It's a business much like commercial fishing, difficult to plan. Standards keep getting higher. Markets are very, very difficult. It sounds like they have similar problems in California, other growing areas in California, in Tamales Bay, Drake's Bay, and Eureka, and then up in Oregon and Washington, too.
Thank you. Just before our next speaker, I'd like to introduce Mary Fulward. Mary is coming forward as the Sierra Club's representative on the Marine Interest Group. And before she introduces herself, and I wanted to take the moment to thank Leslie Krinsk, who's been serving on the Marine Interest Group for a number of years now, and a very eager and active and contributing member. And thank you very much, Leslie. And I know you made a special effort to take the time to brief Mary on the activities of the Marine Interest Group, and I know that Mary's taking her own time to be getting up to speed. Even watched a previous video of the Marine Interest Group sessions to get some feeling for what's going on with the group. So, Mary, we welcome you and thank you, and we thank Leslie for her service. And invite you to offer a few comments, Mary.
You'll have to tell me if I'm close enough to the mic. This is new for me. My name is Mary Fullwood. I consider myself a bridge maker. I'm involved on lots of different environmentally oriented projects. I'm the Los Osos representative for the San Luis Bay chapter of the Surfrider Foundation, and as the representative, I'm highly involved in the Los Osos sewer project, and really hoping that the project be one that brings great care to the bay, since it's the most still part of the bay that the sewer would be impacting. In my relationship with Surfrider, we've created a coalition with Slow Green Build and Sierra Club, creating a group called Appropriate Technologies, and through Appropriate Technologies, we've been working on LIDs, low impact development strategies, and we recently received a grant from NEP to work on rainwater garden education. Let's see what else. This is new for me to be here, so thanks for having me. I want to take a holistic view to the watershed. I kayak. I live in across from Monarch Grove Elementary School in Los Osos. I'm very aware when I'm walking back from kayaking how many cigarette butts are by the gutters these days, and how that, you know, just going right directly into the bay. What type of impact does that have? I'm interested in creating a plastics program, education. I know Mark Hutchinson with the county is involved in that, interested in that. And so that's pretty much where I am. I do everything I can to create bridging.
Thank you very much, Mary. Welcome. Dean.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. Hello, my name is Dean Wendt. I'm a professor at the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences at Cal Poly, and I'm the director of San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, SLOSI, as you may have heard it. And I'm also, I guess I was thinking, I'm also on the Morro Bay National Estuary Program Executive Committee. I want to tell you about a couple of things, and then a little later in the agenda, I'm also going to spend a little bit of time giving you a more thorough update on SLOSI. But since the last time that we met, one of the biggest things that's happened with the local work that we've been doing that was started here in the Marine Interest Group, that's the collaborative fisheries work, is we've been refunded for another year to work with fishermen to monitor the new marine protected areas that we have as a result of the Marine Life Protection Act. So this is a program that you're going to hear even more about, because one of the students, Leslie Longebach, is here tonight to tell us a little bit about opportunities for recreational anglers. She'll be on later, so stay tuned. But the good news is we received funding again from the OPC and the Coastal Conservancy, and then also the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, to work with both commercial and recreational fishermen throughout the southern central coast. So that's all the way up through Half Moon Bay. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about SLOSI later on. We're in the process of coming up for our renewal funding, so it's been 2.5 years, and I'll fill you in on how that's going.
Great. Thanks, Dean. And Matt Fleming joined us since we started the round. So, Matt, would you give us any updates that are pertinent for you?
Well, I'm
as I mentioned, I think our last meeting, I'm no longer the chair for the Surfrider Foundation, which is the at-large position I was in here, but I still work closely with them. I spend enough time on it that I, as chair, that I work as an advisor for them, and so I'm sitting on the MIG representing the at-large.
Here, we've got a really full agenda tonight. I wanted to recognize Monica Hunter, who is a member of the Regional Water Quality Control Board itself, a very important role here in our community, and she has something to share with us about a topic that she'd addressed at last meeting, which is what are some of the efforts to link the land and the sea? So she's got a minute or two of overview about that to share with you. So Monica, welcome, and I guess you have a handout that you're offering. Sure.
I'll stand right here. I appreciate having a chance to give you an update quickly on the Custom Ocean Regional Roundtable Project, which is a project of the Planning and Conservation League Foundation. Some of you may know me from that work. I've been working since 2004, and that project encompasses San Mateo, Santa Cruz, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo counties. We just received word that we've been funded for a second year of Coastal Ocean Regional Roundtable, also by Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, an entity that's done a lot of good work in San Luis Obispo County, so I'm glad to be part of that. What I've passed out for you today is just a couple of brief kind of glimpses of what we accomplished in our first year. We held meetings in two counties last year, and in San Luis Obispo County, we had over 50 people attend a one-day-long seminar on coastal and coastal watersheds and marine resource management issues. The intent of the program was to bring folks together who are doing coastal stream and coastal watershed resource management. Some very capable folks who've been working on non-point source pollution for the last number of maybe a decade now, together with folks who are working on marine conservation, because we know that the impacts to water quality of the near shore and intertidal area directly links to land use issues. So the effort was a good start. You'll note on the back of the, there is a list there of the planning group members for each county, just for you to note who was involved last year. We hope that group, those groups will grow. We hope that we're looking forward to establishing a similar planning group in Santa Cruz County. On the back side of that sheet with the planning group, you'll see the 7 recommended actions that came out of the one-day workshop, and that's going to be the platform for initiating this year's work. I expect that set of priorities to get better defined through various methods. We'll be working closely in this county with ECOSLO. They were our partner last year in conducting this event, and we'll have on staff this have a chance to have make that happen. So unless anybody has any questions, I do intend to follow up. Many of you attended, some of you from the MIG attended, some of you in the room tonight attended, and I will be following up with you, and I'm interested, Don, in understanding how MIG and the mutual interests that these kinds of events reflect, how we can build on the efforts of MIG. You guys have done a lot of great work, and you've been here for a number of years now, and certainly our effort is one of addressing the Central Coast more broadly, but I'm delighted to be able to work in my home county, which is not often the case. So I look forward to having some interaction and getting some input from you all on the priority issues that you've worked so hard to define.
Okay, thanks a lot, Monica. So at this juncture, what we're going to do is go into the major presentations. At the end of each meeting of the Marine Interest Group, the group identifies what are core topics they'd like to be addressing. And they all relate back to what were the key strategic initiatives identified in 2003 after really a year-long effort of understanding the status of the resources and what things needed attention. 3 of the topics that came out of that strategic set of initiatives are the topics for discussion tonight. One is a set of topics around water quality. Everyone realizes that the ocean waters are like the blood in our system. It needs to be clean and healthy. There's important efforts going on around that. So that's one set of topics. Another set of topics is, you know, what can be done to support a sustainable local fishery and fishing community. And then a third is what can be done to improve the base of knowledge and understanding about the marine environment so that better and more well-informed decisions can be made. So those are our three major topics for tonight. We're going to kick off under the improved water quality with a discussion about low-impact development with Matt Thompson of the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And I know, Ray, you helped in identifying Matt. Would you like to take a moment just to provide a context for your interest around this? And then we'll turn it over to Matt for a presentation.
Well, when the MIG expressed their interest in low-impact development, I volunteered to find a speaker because my wife works at the Water Quality Board, and she actually worked for Matt for a while. She was dealing with the low-impact development. She's been reassigned to other things there now, so I was pretty sure I could get a speaker. So
I'm an environmental engineer. I'm the relatively new manager of the stormwater program at the Central Coast Water Board. For those of you that are unfamiliar with the Water Board, we're basically responsible for implementing the water pollution control provisions of the California Water Code and the Clean Water Act. You know, many of you know that we're involved in wastewater facilities, but we actually regulate all activities and land uses, really, that can affect water quality. And so one of those areas that I'm here to talk to you about is stormwater quality. You know, this is a, you might be wondering what this figure is showing. This is showing the most intensive land uses in the lower Salinas Valley in the Monterey Peninsula area. The areas in red indicate imperviousness, and the areas in green indicate irrigated agriculture. And it's become clear to us at the Central Coast Water Board that these two intense land uses probably have the single biggest effect on water quality, not just in these watersheds, but probably in the marine environment as well. So my presentation is kind of geared towards like watershed health, but I'm sure you understand that, you know, if you take care of the watersheds, you're also taking care of coastal water quality as well. So let me just get into this. There's a big effort going on at the Central Coast Water Board. We have a renewed vision for healthy functioning watersheds. We've established three big goals that by 2025, 80% of our lands will be sustainably managed. 80% of aquatic habitat will be healthy. 80% of groundwater will be clean, and the remaining 20% will be improving in each of these areas. We've sort of reestablished this vision at a time when there's a lot going on in the Central Coast region. I mean, you guys know that there's, you know, we're right between these metropolitan areas. There's a lot of development pressure in the Central Coast. I mean, we know there are big plans for development in places like San Benito County, around Salinas, actually the whole Salinas Valley, Paso Robles, Santa Maria. There's really a lot going on. What's clear to us already, I mean, we've established these goals and we're sort of charting our path. It's not going to get done. And so we need to develop the metrics that we're going to use to measure our progress in achieving.
Well, I was just wondering, if 80% is your goal, where are we now? And so how much of a movement is that?
Well, I can't say definitively right now, but I can tell you we're nowhere close to 80%. Huh. I mean, I heard a presentation today from our ambient monitoring folks that, you know, we monitor ambient water quality across the Central Coast region, and there are like 150 stretches of waterways that they monitor, and probably only, let's see, 80, 50, only about 40% of them are considered swimmable. So, and that's just one of the beneficial uses is water contact recreation. So that's pretty low.
So do you have baseline information that you're going to be working from?
Yeah, we have an established, we call it the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. Okay. And it's been in existence now for about 12 years. And so the idea is to understand ambient water quality And we're going to continue with that program from here on out, and so we'll be able to evaluate trends. The data that we've collected so far are the basic water quality parameters, and we're working on developing some more advanced water quality parameters that are a better indication of aquatic health. So that's a big effort. There's a small army working on that very issue. So I just want to, for those of you, I just want to give you a quick rundown on hydrology to explain why we believe that low-impact development is necessary. These are aerial photographs of the same scale of neighboring lands out on the Highway 68 corridor in Monterey County. And so I would encourage you to think about what happens when you take natural land and you develop it in a conventional manner. It's graded, it's compacted, the topography changes, you're adding hardscape. Engineers would say that the coefficient of runoff increases and that the time of concentration decreases. Engineers talk in terms of hydrographs, and this is what happens to the hydrograph. This is basically the x-axis is time, big spike in the hydrograph. Engineers are obviously well aware of this. This is what causes flooding. And so, the way they've dealt with this, well, let me back up. This is an example of what can happen. This is our local downtown Atascadero in 2001. You can see the creek is like completely separated from the floodplain. It's deeply incised. There's mass wasting of the creek bank happening. This is an example of a watershed that has really lost its function. So the way the engineers have dealt with this is they'll just add a detention basin to the tail end of a neighborhood. The idea would be to kind of slow down the flow. And all these, this is an example of a detention basin for a relatively new neighborhood in Watsonville. You can see these little detention basins are capturing runoff from these big neighborhoods. So what those detention basins do is essentially knock down the hydrograph to sort of shave off the peak so you don't get flooding. Well, what happens is because if you have all this extra imperviousness and there's less water infiltrating into the ground, all you're doing is you're sort of bleeding the water out over a longer period of time. I should have mentioned earlier that the area under the curve represents the total volume that's going down the waterway. And so what happens is you knock down the peak, but you still have all this additional volume. And you think, well, water in creeks is good. What's the matter with water in the creek? The problem is that, creeks can't handle more, than their natural condition. And so with this increased runoff volume, we know that we have less water infiltrating into the soil. Therefore, you're not recharging groundwater, which is a problem, especially in the Central Coast region, where we're primarily dependent on groundwater for our municipal supply. If you're shooting it off into the waterway, you're reducing base flow to the creeks. This groundwater, when you recharge groundwater, you're sustaining the base flow that sustains these creeks through the dry season. And so when you reduce base flow, you reduce it also affects the riparian vegetation, which is what aquatic habitat really is. And so with this increased volume going into the waterway, it not only carries additional pollutants, but it is running over these hardscaped areas, these hot areas, and the water that's going into the stream is low impact development principles. So what is low-impact development? This is what it looks like at the site level. It's much bigger than this. Low-impact development is planning and designing development to avoid natural features. It's avoiding natural drainage ways. It's about minimizing grading. It's about setting development back from natural water courses. But when you get down to the site level, it's a bunch of little things that combined help to mimic natural hydrology, even though you have roofed areas and paved areas. So sometimes we have these compacted clay soils. You have to sometimes amend the soils. We have these things called rain gardens, which essentially behave like miniature retention basins, just to soak up all the runoff from these roofed areas It's about using rain barrels and cisterns, using porous pavement where possible so you don't, it's not running off. It's about minimizing and disconnecting impervious surfaces so you have narrower streets. I'll show you some photos in a minute. It's also about having open drainage ways instead of, you know, underground storm drain pipes to kind of slow the flow down, allow it to soak into the ground. It's about using natural features like plants to essentially treat the stormwater runoff. Here's what it looks like. This is an example from the Northwest. I don't think this is a great example for the arid Central Coast region because of all the turf, but you get the idea. The rain garden is basically a shallow depression on the side of the road that's filled with sandy soil and wetland-type plants where, like, runoff from these roofed areas can kind of soak into the ground rather than just run off into the street and down the drains. Here's another example from Seattle. This is a popular example. Their Street Edge Alternatives Project. This used to be a typical neighborhood with a wide street and curb and gutter and that kind of thing. They ripped it all out, and they retrofitted it with this. You can see it's a very narrow street. They have, you can see there's no curb and gutter, and so what that allows is for the runoff to just kind of sheet off the side of the road and to soak into the ground rather than to concentrate and send it downstream. And it looks really good. Here's another example from the same street. Low impact development is about sort of integrating your drainage features with your landscape features. So this thing, it's a little bit fuzzy, but this is a, they put these little rock check dams in there and they planted it. And it basically slows down the flow, allows it to soak in the ground, and any heavy flows, it actually treats it a little bit before it gets into the lagoon further downstream. Actually, I think this drains directly to the ocean. So, let's see. Oh, here's another local example. This is might not look like low-impact development, but this is a low-impact development practice. This is a relatively new parking lot at Cal Poly. It's out by the rodeo grounds. But you can see, you might not be able to see it, but this is porous pavement. And what they did is a huge parking lot. And so rather than paving the whole parking lot in porous pavement, because it's more expensive than conventional asphaltic concrete, they just took a like 40 or 50 foot wide swath at the downstream end of this big parking lot. And so all the sheet flow that comes off that parking lot in the background basically soaks into the ground. Should have mentioned this porous pavement is underlain with a thick bed of gravel. And so what's really cool about this is that although they still have all this curb and gutter around the edge, they probably could have got away. They probably could have got away with not doing any of that, because the runoff literally just soaks into the ground. It doesn't concentrate anywhere. They don't have any oversight drains to nearby creeks, and so if there's excess flow, it just kind of seeps out of the toe of the gravel bed. It's works pretty good. But this is an experiment. This was Mino Construction's first project with porous pavement, and I've heard there's some problems that it's kind of unraveling. So you can't use porous pavement where there's a lot of vehicle traffic. You have to kind of use it on parking areas and sidewalks and that kind of thing where there's less heavy, you know, truck traffic, that kind of thing. So low impact development practices, if you implement them properly, you can get a hydrograph that essentially mimics the pre-development condition. That's our goal. We believe that if you mimic the pre-development condition, you soak as much water into the ground as you can, you minimize how much runoff's going into our waterways and into the ocean, and you prevent our creeks from unraveling. So I mentioned earlier that there are some other side benefits to low-impact development. First and foremost, for the developers that apparently are not in the room, no developers here tonight. I'm used to talking to developers, but low impact, let me back up. US EPA did a thing. Let's see. In Seattle, they found that it improved the way the neighborhood looked, the whole look and feel of the neighborhood. And they found that in Seattle, let me back up. With low impact development, it's kind of about clustering. Rather than have like 10,000 square foot lots with big, huge yards, they might have 6,000 square foot lots with more open space. So they found that it invited people to get outdoors and, you know, kind of share the open space. So there's expanded recreational opportunities. They found that the neighborhoods were more desirable, therefore property values were higher in those low-impact development neighborhoods. Like I said, it's about clustering, so they have actually increased density, which is the buzz with planners, is increased density, walkable neighborhoods, that kind of thing. And they found that because it's different, that there's increased marketing potential and those properties sold faster. This is really for the development community. And I have copies of this study if any of you are interested. So, what, you know, recognizing all these benefits, the implementation of low-impact development is a big priority for the Central Coast Water Board. And we have a multi-pronged approach to implementing low-impact development. First one is that we're trying to set up enforceable requirements. You know, we regulate cities through stormwater management programs. You know, a stormwater management program is used to control urban stormwater, kind of like how wastewater collection and treatment systems are used to control wastewater. And so what, in order, a lot of these communities are writing stormwater management programs now, which are a plan for how they intend to control stormwater runoff for the next 5 or 10 years. And so, but it's required by an NPDES permit, and so it must be approved by the Central Coast Water Board. The Water Board has basically said that they cannot approve stormwater management programs unless that program will essentially result in implementation of low-impact development. What this is requiring are these communities to revise their development standards. Actually, it's requiring them to kind of almost can their old development standards, get rid of the old way of doing it, and write new development standards that will effectively implement LID, drainage and hydrology and watershed health in addition to all those factors. So enough said about requirements. This is actually subject of a lot of debate and discussion at the Central Coast Water Board right now. Another thing the Water Board is doing is they're setting up technical assistance. The Water Board recently established an endowment to provide funding for the Central Coast Low Impact Development Center. Now, why do we need this Low Impact Development Center? What this will be, it will be like a clearinghouse for low impact development information on the West Coast. And the Low Impact Development Center will have staff that will be able to assist cities to write the codes, the ordinances, and the development standards they need to implement low-impact development. It will also provide guidance to the engineering community. You know, engineering consultants need to learn how to do this stuff. It's relatively new, and we're all still learning how to do it. And so they need to be able to go to an expert to teach them how to do it. One of the big goals, one of our big goals with the Central Coast LID Center will be to get a large-scale low-impact development project in the ground that we can all go and look at and learn from. So the next thing we're doing is, Mary?
Your location?
Well, it's brand new. This is brand new, and we're happy to report that we've hired a nationally known low-impact development center out of the city of Seattle, Darla Inglis. She's widely regarded as one of the foremost LID experts in the nation. And she's going to be relocating to San Luis Obispo and setting up shop. She'll probably temporarily be housed in the Central Coast Water Board offices, but the idea is that we'll get her set up in a place like Cal Poly, because the Central Coast LID Center is going to direct their own work. The Water Board is not going to be directing their work. We're going to be funding them, but they are going to be setting their priorities. And so it's going to be essentially free consulting for the development community. This is a this is essentially a nonprofit consulting group. So we expect Darla to come to town in September. So coming soon. Third thing we're doing is funding assistance. You know, the Central Coast Water Board is not the only agency that is hot on low-impact development. All the other resources agencies are as well. I mean, sure, you've heard Ocean Protection Council talking about it. It's and I think stormwater, you can hear stormwater control, but knowing State Water Resources Control Board's desire for low-impact development implementation, my thinking is that project proposals that result in good low-impact development implementation will be very competitive for this funding. I believe a lot of Central Coast communities stand to benefit from this, but they got to get together and apply. Last thing, you know, we're Water Board staff are out there. We're meeting with decision makers, city managers, public works directors, planning officials. We're meeting with the development community, folks like you. We can talk to them, but I'm convinced that unless the public demands this, you know, they show up at public meetings, that the development community is still going to be reluctant to do that. So why would they be reluctant to do that? Well, I mean, part of regulating water quality is kind of like social engineering. So we're always, I feel more like a social scientist than an engineer sometimes. But what I've noticed is that people are just resistant to change. I mean, especially local agencies in the development community. They've been doing curb and gutter and sidewalk for decades, you know. And so they're kind of resistant to doing it, even though they know what they're currently doing may not be the ideal, just because it's different, you know, because they have to learn something new. So the challenge is to educate them, because we're all on this really steep learning curve. And so that's one of the things we're trying to address through the Central Coast LID Center. Another obstacle is that everybody's definition of low impact development differs. You know, public works officials, they're typically civil engineers, and so they kind of see low impact development as a really neat drainage tool. You know, it's like a different way to do drainage. But what we want communities to do is to think about how they develop the land in the very early planning stages of projects. So planners, on the other hand, they kind of see it as a kind of a nice community planning tool. So the challenge is to get planners and public works officials together to get the right definition of low impact development. Another thing that we're hearing is that low impact development could conflict with other requirements. Think back to the photo of the Seattle with this, you know, it's not going to happen overnight, but you know, I'm confident that if we can start on a small scale, we can eventually change the way land is developed and have healthy watersheds. So I think that's all. I'm sorry to go over time, but if any of you have questions for me, I'm...
Yeah, I do have kind of an underlying question, and that is, while I agree with the design effort to make the natural rainfall runoff handled properly and cleanly, is there an underlying engineering design element that can handle the severe runoff so that we don't end up with an overwhelming hit on that capacity of those smaller units that could cause flooding in houses or destroy roads or things like that? Is there an underlying design that can handle the larger flow as well?
Yeah, good question. You know, I would encourage you to think about a pristine watershed. When they get hammered with a big storm, those waterways, they don't unravel. Because even though there's heavy flows going down that watershed, there's a proper balance of water and sediment, and you don't see the major erosion that you're normally seeing. You know, what we've learned, my understanding, is that the major channel-forming flows are the small flows. And so you don't necessarily need an enormous retention basin. You can sort of decentralize those things and sort of distribute little retention devices throughout the neighborhood and mimic the natural condition and not have to worry so much about the big, huge flows. So,
other questions? Deborah?
Yeah, this is a follow-up. Have you modeled the runoff capacity to match the rainfall associated with an El Nino cycle? because it's not merely seasonal, it's also the large volumes of water, which is where most of the flooding occurs, is during El Ninos.
Yeah, that's a really tough question. Understand our role. We're the regulator. We set conditions that we expect the regulated community to meet, and so they end up having to get high-power consultants. I understand that a lot of them they have to model. Once a site gets above a certain size, they will model it, and they will plug in all the data that they have. And right now, we typically have 50, 60. I don't think it's insurmountable. I mean, I've heard horror stories from the metropolitan areas, and so I guess relative to the metropolitan areas, our resistance is relatively light. I'm actually quite surprised. Much of the development community, they get it. I mean, they see how special this area is, and they're kind of willing to do it. You know, for the most part, they're open to kind of maintaining that. But there's definitely pushback because they see they got to make changes. It might cost them a little bit to implement the changes, but I think it's surmountable. And the way is you just set requirements. You know, a lot of them, they just say, just tell me exactly what you want me to do and I'll do it. And so that's why our strategy is to go to the local agencies to get them to set up requirements that effectively require LID.
So. Any other questions?
Again, I live in Los Osos, and Los Osos Valley Road is a rather wide road, and you're talking predominantly about new development projects, but with an example where Los Osos roads will be being torn up, and Los Osos Valley Road in particular being exceptionally wide for the size of the community, are you going to be playing a role in working with the county to consider, particularly with LOV, making it a little bit more of a community-oriented street as opposed to looking like a thoroughfare?
Yeah, I mean, understand our role is water quality protection and not so much in community planning. I mean, we're not like planners where we're into like how the look and the feel of the street is, you know, but right now with County of San Luis Obispo, they received a Proposition 40 grant through the water boards to develop a low-impact development design standards manual, and their draft is coming out this fall, and my understanding is that if they implement that, it may result in some retrofits. You're right, we're kind of geared towards new development because it's just more cost effective to kind of do it right the first time than have to like go back into the existing built environment and retrofit. But, at some point we're going to have to start thinking about how we're going to go back into these existing developed areas and undo some historic damage. So.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I know that one of the things that really...
Sure, well, I'm kind of working with the city, so I'm kind of an urban guy, but we have a whole other program that works with agriculture. And I can tell you that the Pajaro watershed, Santa Cruz, Monterey County, the Salinas Valley watershed, and the Santa Maria watershed, there's a lot of pollutant loading coming from those watersheds. And it's I think, a mix of urban and agricultural sources. And so this is, one of our efforts to address the urban sources. Should have mentioned, a lot of studies show that a lot of the toxicity, a lot of the pesticides and such that are coming out of these watersheds are from the urban environment. I mean, a lot of people think that, farmers are applying a lot of pesticides and such, but, reality is that many of them are trained how to properly do it, whereas a typical homeowner tends to over-apply. And so... My hope is that if we get what we call structural controls, we get LID in the ground and we maximize infiltration, that we will address some of that toxicity coming from the urban environment.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. So last time there were questions and concerns expressed about how sewage spills impact the marine environment, how they're managed, when they happen, what are the consequences of those that cause those, and Matt Fleming agreed to do some research about that. So, Matt, what did you learn?
Well, I spent time talking to a number of different people, a lot of the Matt's colleagues from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, Dave Licaro, who is in charge of permits, inspections, and complaints for wastewater, sewage treatment. And as I was talking to him, I kept asking him kind of global questions and then specific questions because I was fairly ignorant to all the inner workings of it because there are so many and so complicated and everything. And at one point, I stopped taking notes and I said, well, you just need to maybe come in as well and give this talk to the MIG. And so he agreed to do that because it was just like, it's such a critical thing that we have all been reading about in the newspapers about, for instance, the Men's Colony spill and all these other spills that occur, and it was cost prohibitive so that it becomes less likely. Because that's the questions I kept going back with, was, well, what could the general public or what could the MIG or what could a group of interested people or parties do to not make a sewage spill happen? I mean, is it possible to not make them happen? And again, thinking of the Men's Colony, thinking of San Simeon had a spill, and I surfed out there the days before, and so it's something that's kind of it really hits the public because I think it's profound. It's all at once. Although, and I'm sure this, you know, this probably is true, that there's more issue with stormwater runoff in terms of everyday pollutants. And there's a, I also talked to Jill Falcone from the county, who is one of the many groups that is the interagency coalition, Slo County Partners for Water Quality and Stormwater Pollution Prevention. And she didn't work, and none of those worked directly with all the sewage treatment, but they all get together and talk about what everybody is doing. And I said, okay, here I come from the outside on this, asking, you know, why do these things happen, and how do you set a fine for being the right amount and everything? And he had all those answers. And when I talked to Jill Falcone, she said that, well, there's tons of work being done out there. There's no question that everybody is working hard to improve the watershed and to do all these things. And what she thought was lacking most, and I thought this what was most helpful maybe for the MIG, and not surprising, is that she said to get the various agencies to realize how much the public cares. And I know that's the typical answer that we always see: get the bodies out to the city council meeting, get the bodies out to the coastal commission meeting, or whatever it might be. And I said, well, you know, if as a group, as the MIG, we became more educated with that program that's being implemented, the various groups that are working together on this huge issue, that we could lend our unified voice to issues that we all could agree upon. And one of the ones that Jill Falcone brought up was in March of 2009, they are going to be going forward with a plastics ban. And I know that was brought up at the last meeting we had. And I said, okay, take that for example, because I'm always trying to get down to, you know, well, give me one thing that we could suggest. And I wasn't sure if I should have put it on this meeting as Ray did or not, but that Dave come talk to us. And that maybe after hearing about what he has to say just about the permitting process, then we can also at some point have Jill Falcone come in and talk to us as well about which issues we might get behind that would help all these groups that are working hard out there get things done. You know, and for instance, the sewage spill. There's a lot of controversy going on about how much the fine is. And one of the things that I was told could possibly change that fine is how much the public cares. You know, that it's not always just set in stone, and it's not always completely decided in a vacuum at all. It public outcry matters, and obviously educated public outcry from a group that is very concerned about the watershed and about water quality could probably have a great impact. So I'd like him to come in next time if that's something we can work out. And
so just to note this, that's Dave.
Dave Licaro. And
he's from Matt, the Water Board?
He is. He's in charge of the permitting, or he works in permitting and inspections and complaints. Is that right, Matt?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to save some time and effort.
I thought you might.
I mean, if I could take 4 minutes and answer all the maybe questions or clarifications about the permitting process, would you mind?
Would that be helpful? Would the working committee like to do that for a few minutes?
Sure.
I'll make
it quick. I promise. I realize you're not going to ever want to invite me back. I never open my mouth. But I mean, I guess I appreciate the primer there. I would start by trying to put things in perspective. I mean, I would encourage you to think, for every gallon of sewage that is spilled, to think about how much is properly treated and disposed in a safe manner. And I would say that the amount of sewage that is spilled is a very, very small percentage of the wastewater that we generate every day. So saying that, I mean, I say that because I think that the people that manage these wastewater collection and treatment systems, they're not eco-criminals that desire to have sewage spills. They are managing their wastewater collection and treatment systems the best they know how with the limited resources that they have. And so huge federal grants to pay for their sewage systems. And those federal grants dried up in the mid-80s. And so, and many of the much of this infrastructure is reaching the end of its useful life, and these cities are going to have to upgrade. And so they don't have federal grants anymore. And so they need to raise the revenue. And so what that means is that rates are going to have to go up. And a problem that we're running into is that a lot of people really freak out when you want to raise rates a few bucks a month. So maybe that's somehow, maybe you could somehow help with that. As far as, you know, setting fines, you know, I was involved. I drafted the complaint for the California Men's Colony. I don't think this is an appropriate forum to discuss how we do that, but you know, we consider a variety of factors when proposing a particular penalty amount. It is not arbitrary. And in this case, I believe we appropriately considered all the factors. I think that's all we can say on that at this point. So if you want any more Water Board perspective, I'd be glad to.
Yeah, I just, on the issue of funding, because I know that that's the case in Morro Bay and everywhere where yes, that absolutely everybody's working as hard as they can to make these things not occur. And I guess from the outside perspective, that's the answer I was looking for is like, okay, what would be the greatest benefit besides obviously something we couldn't pull off, which is just handing millions of dollars to everybody to finally have the funding to do what they need to do. But what would be the best thing for an organization or this committee, for instance, to do to move that along in ways that the operators are not able to, the Regional Water Quality Control Board is not able to, because that's the real issue there. And I always felt like, for instance, with the Men's Colony spill, that all of the that was a new treatment plant. And so that just made me wonder, okay, if a new treatment plant has a spill, I agree for the ratio of how much spill there is to how much is treated and done correctly, it's a very efficient and effective method. But, of course, that's not the way it looks when you're kayaking in the bay after the 40,000-gallon spill. I mean, that's just the nature of it. But what could...
Yeah, I guess what I was suggesting. Well, let me back up. I think the recent Men's Colony spill was really an exceptional case. They lost power, and their brand new power generator had an electrical problem that was really, I think, difficult for anybody to anticipate. But as far as what the public can do, our infrastructure is aging. And they need to upgrade their infrastructure. And so what I'm suggesting is that the feds aren't going to come in and save the day, that our local communities are going to have to pay for these things. And so I think what I would suggest is that when your local government proposes rate increases to improve their wastewater infrastructure, to look into why. It's not, they just don't want to increase their paychecks. They truly want to improve their how they manage their wastewater collection and treatment systems.
Well, for instance, with Morro Bay, though, which we have just done that, and those rates will be taking place, assuming that that wasn't an exceptional case, which I hope it is, with the men's colony, you can be doing all that stuff. But as we talk about watersheds, somewhere upstream, if somebody's not doing it, then you have to get them on board. Or if that, as with the men's colony, it's a separate entity, it becomes a little bit of a challenge for those downstream to know.
Sure. Well, and that's where water board enforcement comes in. You know, water board enforcement is intended to deter those types of violations. So you can get involved with how the water board responds to those. You know, like I said, CMC is exceptional. It's sort of a quasi-governmental. It's not a like a city where they're you know, there's a council that you can go to, but you know, you can rely on water board processes. So.
PJ,
I'm really glad to see these water quality issues continue here at the MIG. You may have recalled in the past that I got a printout of the number of spills that had been documented over a three-month period, and if you recall, that was front and back of about six pages. There are, a number of spills that happen, and we don't hear about them because unless they're in the newspaper, which every so often we do hear, prepared to do. The government is what makes the infrastructure for dealing with these urban runoff and the septic problem. So I'd like to keep this on the table, and I'd like for us to consider maybe in the future, in addition to having more presentations on the permitting process and possibly with Jill and the new plastics ban, I'd like to keep it on the table for us to continue to educate ourselves and the public, because I really do think that the infrastructure problem is only going to get worse. It's been a concern of mine. I live in Cambria. We know about the water problems that we have in Cambria, and it is a very difficult question for the public when they are presented with, we know everyone's hurting economically, we need a rate increase. Why do you need the rate increase? Well, there's always a lot of factors to consider, but infrastructure is very important.
Carolyn?
I think it would be really helpful if we... I think it would be very helpful if we itemized what funding opportunities there are available. Isn't there a state infrastructure bank that makes money available to communities for sewage or infrastructure improvements? I know that Pismo Beach recently completed their new facility, and I thought they had money from a state fund. So I think there may be monies out there that we're not familiar with, and maybe we need to find out really what is out there. And as I looked around regarding the plastics issue, I learned from solid waste management people that there is this pending plastics ban. And I don't know, I didn't find out. Is there legislation that is authorizing that, or what is the source of this movement that's going to be taking place in March?
Jill had said that in March she was going in front of
Jill, when I talked to her, she said she was going, and I can't remember whether she was going in front of a board or what, but it was a plastic bags ban. I think it was for the county.
Well, CalFed watershed program is now statewide, and we have, I think, 11 hydrologic units. in the statewide watershed program. And Bridget Luther is directing that. It is a California Resources Agency program, but it's been housed at the Department of Conservation, where she is the director. And one of her big priorities is to use some monies that have accumulated in the Recycle Bottled Water Fund. They're required to keep that money moving out into the communities. She's very keen on seeing something develop for plastic debris and debris removal programs. And it's very new, and I don't know if any of you had a chance to go to the recent statewide watershed workshops that were conducted. I think there were four of them up and down the state. We should be hearing more about how that program is going forward, but certainly we're all paying attention to a nice multi-million dollar fund that could fund. And that's one program that does fund education and outreach, which is really hard to find dollars to support that. So something to follow up on that.
I noticed that we have the manager for the Morro Bay Cuyahoga's sewage treatment plant here raising his hand, indicating he's got a comment. So if you'd please join us at the microphone, just introduce yourself so people know you.
I manage the wastewater treatment plant for the city of Morro Bay. I really appreciate Matt bringing this to the attention of everybody. I think it's we've heard a lot of like information kind of float around. I think the lady over here mentioned education, and that one of maybe the biggest asset you can help us out with is education. Education's my biggest tool. I think the message that we can get out that's low tech is that what you flush down your toilet is going to the ocean. What you throw in the street is going to the ocean. And if we can get people to start just thinking along those lines, don't flush unused medication. I'm on a cat litter campaign through the regional board to tell people not to flush cat litter. Pick up your dog poop. Little basic things that we're going to have to tackle infrastructure as we go on, and education is going to help us do that. But there's lots of things that people do in their daily lives. We have sewer spills. Why do sewers spill? Why do wastewater treatment plants spill? Wastewater treatment plants are incredibly complex pieces of machinery. They're systems that fit together. In CMC, that I think this group as a whole can help reach out on the education aspect and say, hey, you know what, everything we do, global warming is a perfect example. We're having to make changes, or we will have to make changes in our daily lives. The same goes for water quality and wastewater. So I think this group could really help all of the wastewater agencies and the regulatory agencies just by keep bringing the topic up and letting people hear about it. And it makes them start to think that, you know, there are ways to help out. Thanks.
Thank you, Bruce. PJ.
Just to clarify, one of the things that's also mentioned on the spill report is not just simply sewage spills, but also spills that take place at manufacturing plants and other places where spills occur that go into the watershed. So it isn't all municipal sewage treatment. So we have to keep in mind, too, in addition to what we have through agriculture, what we have domestically through our households, but then there's also other areas or focal points of pollution that go into the watershed. So I want to just make sure that point was made. It wasn't just simply sewage treatment plants.
Okay. What I suggest that we do with regard to interest in pursuing this further is, why don't you sort of mull that over for a little bit, and then at the end of tonight's session we'll talk about, given all the things, topics that have come up and discussion points and new things that maybe people have in mind, which of those you'd like to address at the next meeting. So why don't you kind of cogitate about that a bit, and we'll come back to that at the end to figure out where you might like to go next. We're moving on now to the next segment here, which is about ways to support local sustainably caught fish. And I know that the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization, the Port St. Louis Fishermen's Association, the Nature Conservancy, and others are working on this. Do we have some update that you could offer that would be helpful to the community about where you are, what's happening, and what can people do?
We could do a quick update, or I have a short presentation, too, that Dean has loaded up. I'm not sure if you have the time for that.
And someone's just asking, this is Michael Bell from the Nature Conservancy.
I'm sorry. My name is Michael Bell, and I'm a project director for the Nature Conservancy.
Is it already up on your, loaded up on your, and about how long do you think it might be, just so we can figure?
5 to 10 minutes.
If it I think that's what we...
Ellen, I'm a project director with the Nature Conservancy, and I'm here to talk about a project that's been going on here in Morro Bay, Port San Luis for about 2.5 years called the Central Coast Groundfish Project. The Central Coast Groundfish Project started with a collaborative approach to establish what's called essential fish habitat. The Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which is NIMP's lead advisory body for how they manage the West Coast groundfish fishery, that council was under a court mandate to establish essential fish habitat, which is essentially no trawl zones, up and down the West Coast. This was back in 2005. The Nature Conservancy approached trawl fishermen in Morro Bay with an idea to start a collaborative approach to establish this essential fish habitat. The idea was if the Nature Conservancy could work in a collaborative fashion with those trawl fishermen to both design and then petition the council for this essential fish habitat, we would thereby buy anyone out of the industry that cared to get out of the industry at the end of this process. I should also mention that, unfortunately, the trawl groundfish industry in the West Coast has been in severe economic decline since about the mid-80s due to a lot of different factors that I won't go into, a lot of them regulatory. But suffice to say, there were some fishermen motivated to sell their assets in this fishery and to move on. Slide. So this is a photo of Chuck Cook from the Nature Conservancy working with some trawl fishermen here in the Central Coast. And if you hit one more time, the slide one more time, this is a depiction of the Santa Lucia Bank on a chart. And here we're working together to think about what sort of no-trawl zones or essential fish habitats should be established to protect this pretty important topographic feature off the coast here. Slide. So the end result of this was that we worked in a collaborative fashion to establish 3.8 million acres of these no-trawl zones or essential fish habitat, Area 1, 2, and 3. This is the Santa Lucia Bank. And these shaded areas are the Nature Conservancy's identified high priority areas for biodiversity offshore. So again, the result was the establishment of 3.8 million acres of essential fish habitat, MPAs, and protect marine areas all you want. But if you don't get to the core of the issue, which is how do you establish a sustainable harvest of fish, you're not really achieving anything that's lasting. People are going to eat fish. Fish is still the number one source of protein in the world. So we should be focusing some efforts not only on closing down areas, but improving the harvest of resources. And so we quickly moved towards sort of the same, you know, objective, but with a different strategy here, and that was to establish a more sustainable groundfish industry on the West Coast. And we would categorize that as one by that would reduce the traditional rate of bycatch, reduce seafloor habitat damage, provide viable economic opportunities within a sustainable fishery, and then maybe, you know, put this fourth goal there as a stretch goal, perhaps achieve a sustainable certification for fish here to provide a market distinction and then provide sort of a market incentive for more sustainable harvest. So going right quickly here to the action steps, this is all about using what are now TNC-owned permits in projects that will explore some alternative and hopefully more sustainable ways of harvesting flatfish. A lot of these cases, it's not innovative harvest strategies, they're just different harvest strategies. So the first was the conservation fishing agreement in which we leased back a trawl permit to a local fisherman here, Ed Ewing, and incorporated in that license agreement certain conservation parameters. The second is the exempted fishing permit, which is where we're taking six of our permits and leasing them back to fishermen with the commitment to use alternative gear rather than trawl. And the final action step, and we're really just getting started on this, is to build a new fishing association here in the Central Coast that can hold and manage permits or fishing quota for the long term and incorporate in their bottom line not only an economic bottom line, but also sort of a sustainable harvest parameters. So touching base on the exempted fishing permit project, again, this is a project where the Nature Conservancies and its partners here in the area propose to gear switch with six of the permits that whose groundfish has always been a very critical component of their fishing industry here, to measure how they can move some of their traditional trawl efforts to other fishing efforts like trapping and hook and line, and seeing how that works in a sort of socioeconomic context in this community. The next project is the conservation fishing agreement, and again, this is where we're leasing a permit back to a local fisherman, Ed Ewing. One thing that our partners taught us pretty quickly in this project is that there's a trawling should not, it's not black and white, it's, and too often I think the public thinks this, it's not trawling bad, all the other types of fishing good. Trawling is actually pretty necessary. Flatfish is a very important component of this fishery, and the only way to effectively catch flatfish is with some sort of trawl technique. However, we believe, and this project aims to see if we can't geographically restrict where that trawling occurs, if we can't play with some innovative gear types to improve the type of impact that that trawling would have on the benthic environments. And that's what this project's about. That's been in the water since November. I'm going to skip this slide. This is just some of the data that went into the geographic restrictions in that trawl leaseback project. We first started with trying to determine what the most important fishing areas were for flatfish in this region, taking a look at some of the historical trawl footprints. Go to the next slide. Taking a look, of course, at the seafloor habitat, where is the hard habitat we're trying to protect, where is the soft bottom habitat. And then another layer of data that went into this is the biodiversity index data, a measure of relative biodiversity in this region. The end result was a fishing area that's now being used in the conservation fishing agreement. That's these polygons here, 1, 2, and 3. I think that's my last slide. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That was very
that's
helpful.
Quick, right?
That was very efficient and very informative. Thank you, Michael. And I know that there's been a tremendous amount of work behind that with Rick Algert and with the fishermen and TNC and Environmental Defense. A lot of people have rolled up their...
I mean, do you know those the details on that? I'm just curious in terms of how, what makes someone be able to say, oh, I can dedicate my career to going back and trying this. Where's the security in that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that's something we had to come up to speed on, and probably had some, when we started, we probably had some pretty unrealistic ideas of how that would work. A fisherman needs to know that if he's going to invest in an operation, if he's going to invest in a vessel, invest in gear, that he has the security of knowing that that fishing opportunity is there year after year. And so we're doing this year by year license agreement, single year license agreement, but we've built a relationship with this fisherman. And I think we're on the same page and we understand that we want this to be a long-term effort, barring any disaster or lack of funding or something like that. And that's sort of based on a handshake, but it's been enough for us to move forward and work together. I should also state that, unfortunately, the regulatory structure is such in our fisheries that fishermen are pretty used to uncertainty right now. I think Mark and others around here could probably attest to that. I don't like the fact that this project adds any uncertainty, but they've been in the situation where they've had to take risks for their livelihood before. So,
and I might offer a comment on that too, Mike, is that another angle to that, I think, is that was a great answer too, because uncertainty is a big part of what they have to deal with. So, but a huge concern with most fishermen in this is that they're not going to be stuck in some kind of sharecropper kind of role where the TNC might be in control of the permit and dictate the terms and the economics of the businesses. So this is why it's key to understand that we all have to have this long-term goal of a community-based fishing association or a regional fishing association where the quota or the permits are somehow turned over to the group for the group to manage and the group to own, essentially. And TNC has made that clear to me. They've now put out a statement of their long-term goals and purposes, which includes that. So it's going to be a long road. We're plowing new ground, but this is a very, very important goal that where we want to get to is that the permits that they've acquired, whether it goes to quota or they remain as permits and rights to fish in that way, would be turned over to fishermen to sustain and to own and manage in a way that they can control their fates.
Just an additional comment on
that.
It is final. It is final now, but I let me get another version out that no longer says draft.
I would like to be able to use this on Tuesday night to begin to introduce this to the Harbor Commission to let them know what's been transpiring. So, can I use this?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
At Port St. Louis?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know how many members of the working committee have had an opportunity to sample the fish that have been caught with the gear type that he's describing. Have any of you had a chance to do that?
How would we know?
How would you know? Well, actually, you would go, I guess, to a vendor location where it's identified who the captains are. I would just comment that I've sampled this fish. It's available at the place I know it's available is at Dockside, too. I might have been influenced by the fact that I knew the story behind it, but I was really struck because they have all these restrictions, you know, where they can go and what the conditions are. They're actually making sort of shorter runs of how long they're out there. Therefore, the fish that are coming back have been a shorter time from coming out of the water to when they're hitting the market and when they get to your plate. And I just have to say, I've had some of the most phenomenal Petrelli sole in my life from this experience. So I don't know, that's a sample of one, it's anecdotal, I know that's not scientific, but I think there is, and that's part of what this is all about, is how can, I know that Lisa Weiss and Associates and Dwayne is here from that group, are working on a business plan to help differentiate for the public what not only the ecological benefits are, the environmental benefits are of this, but also that there's a commercial value and differentiation of buying local. So I think there's some very promising things here, and if you haven't had a chance to sample that, maybe it's available elsewhere. Where else does Ed Ewing sell his fish? Do you know?
I think the two big buyers of Ed's fish is Mark Tognazzini and Dockside Restaurant and Central Coast Seafoods.
Okay.
Yeah, so, who distributes, I think, to several different restaurants.
So part of the idea is to figure out, how do you get the story out about this? How do you let people know? How do you get the public behind positive things that are good for the environment and good for the local fishing community?
What makes that label, what makes that such a far reach in terms of, that's exactly what we're talking about here, is a branding of these products. Why is that such a far reach goal?
Well, I think there's a lot of things you can go ahead and brand this fish with right away, locally caught, California produced, that sort of stuff. Go right ahead. But if we're talking about making a distinction of this sort of product or future products, I think there should be some scientific backing of that, a measure of how these harvest techniques are somehow sustainable. They've reached certain standards. And I think that's all very, very feasible, but this is just the beginning of this project. I mean, we're just kind of
right,
just getting started.
Is there a clear entity that would give that approval? I mean, is there a process out there right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There's several groups that do that. Probably the most well-established and most well-known is a group called Marine Stewardship Council. And there's sort of mixed feelings on their certification process and their ultimate label. But it's definitely worth pursuing. I would say they have by far the most well-established process to certify a fishery.
You know, I hate to jump in front too, but I do want to offer one comment. There's a lot of other factors there too, and not the least of which is that, you know, we still have this huge problem of lack of supply, indeterminate supply. You still can't generally get a lot of fresh fish in our market. We only have one trawler regularly working. So we need to work, solve supply problems, open up access again. You know, the market is not open in the way it needs to be, and so that we can get infrastructure going, get processors going again. The chain needs to work before you can brand something and promise people product that you don't have.
And just a quick comment to that, just as an item coming forward. We're going to be moving after this to the Slow Sea Strategic Plan, and one of the core strategies out of that addresses the point that Rick is raising about how do you get the information, how do you get the management to be able to create a season that can support the local fishing community and be sustainable with the fishing resource. But we had PJ and we had Mark.
Just to keep banging that education gong and say that enough.
Mark?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a couple of comments. One would be that actually Central Coast Seafood over in Atascadero, Geocoma, there, they buy about 75 to 90% of what Eddie produces. We buy a small amount because we keep most stuff in-house. There is a few high-end restaurants that purchase from our market also. But it's like PG said, it's about going to your restaurant and asking a server, is it local, and having to be truthful with you and asking some key questions. Educate yourself enough so that they will be truthful with you. Don't let them sell you Pacific Red Snapper. Have them sell you Bank Rockfish or Chili Pepper Rockfish. They should know the species by their name, not by just a generic name of what it is.
Like Pacific Red Snapper?
Yeah, you really shouldn't. You shouldn't buy Pacific Red Snapper. You should buy Rockfish as what they really are. A couple of really good things out of this TNC thing that have been happening is it's given us an opportunity, at least at Dockside, to do some marketing of fish that I don't think you'd ever see anyplace. Skate wings is a good example. Rosy rockfish. It's a small rockfish that doesn't get very big. It's outstanding fish. But it's given us a real opportunity to get some fish that have been underutilized or not utilized. And we've always been about education. I think Geo over the hill, and Tesco, he's really about education now. But the fish buyer has to be truthful, and the person that you buy the fish needs to be truthful back to you. And it's about asking questions and demand that local stuff. Sometimes you're going to pay more for it. For example, ex-vessel price of a trawler here to Eddie's about $1.40, whereas up north it can be 60 or 70 cents. So you're going to pay a little bit more for local, but you're going to get a better product, longer shelf life. And you're going to be contributing to the local economy, which this program's all about, is supporting that local economy.
So I saw Carolyn next, and I don't know if you had something you wanted to ask Deborah.
You know, one of the things that I always do when I order seafood in the restaurant, I always ask if it's local, and they usually tell me no, and often it's imported from Alaska. And then I follow through and I ask them why they don't buy local fish, and the answer is that it's not consistent and dependably available. And I think if we encourage restaurants, if we have a program and we begin to encourage restaurants to promote a catch of the day,
foremost and. And a lot of fish have for example, rockfish we talked about, in days past that was the fish and chips because of the availability. It was consistent. But those fish have all become center of the plate now. And that's why it's important. I was saying that these things are sold for what they are. And they, like you said, Carolyn, they're center of the plate. They're the main. They're not just fish and chips. It's, you know, it's bank rockfish, you know, or avocado cream sauce or something. I mean, it's main plate fish that we catch now. It's not just fish and chips. So I think that's important. But there is places that serve a lot of local product, and it is local product is available almost daily someplace in Morro Bay.
Deborah, well, you had a...
I am in South County.
Question or comment?
Yeah, I have a very brief comment. After the slow sea strategic planning, one of the things that I volunteered to do was see if I could find a store that had fresh local fish in San Luis Obispo. And it took me three or four hits on Google, looking up on websites, and investigating downtown to find a little store down in the far end of Marsh Street that has really good locally, they knew wherever the fish was caught. I don't think they were lying to me. And it was really very nice. And I think it's a shame that there's not more effective marketing if they're, like, I'm living in San Luis Obispo and I had a hard time finding it. What if somebody was just visiting and wanted to have fresh fish and wanted to have a little restaurant where they could have fish, they cook it right there, they could serve them? Why? I'd like to know what the marketing is going to be, because that's really a big part of the education, that you can easily find outlets for fresh fish in all the communities, not just the coastal communities.
And I think that is part of the business planning effort that Dwayne, you and others are working on, is to come up with how to get that word out, how to create that infrastructure and that demand when the supply is available to respond. So I think some of those things are underway, and maybe in future meetings you'll be able to give us some update of, you know, when those things get traction. Okay. Well, with that, let's move on, and thank you very much, Michael, and everyone for your comments on that topic. We're going to move to the third major area of this, which was a key initiative back in 2003 that came out from the Marine Interest Group, was how to improve the fundamental information that's available about the marine environment in a way to be able to make better informed decisions and to really make a difference in the...
For allowing me to report back to you about what we've been up to. As Don said, you know, the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance really grew out of the work of the MIG early on, and we are effectively trying to bring good science to resource management and decision making, not just within fisheries areas, but several different areas. And so I'm going to tell you briefly about some of the recent strategic planning that we've done with this community to focus our direction over the next several years. So I'm going to talk first about the process of planning that the group just underwent. We've been around for 2.5 years now, and so it really was a good time for us early on to say, how are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing well? Where could we improve? And how can we grow the organization in a way that makes it more meaningful to the people involved? So I'm going to talk then after about the planning process, a little bit about the proposed strategies for the next several years for the group. And then I'm going to seek, and I am seeking, support from the Marine Interest Group in the form of a letter of support, because we are now re-entering our quest for funding over the next year or so. And so it would be very helpful to have the support of this group as we go out and try to secure funding. So you may remember, you may not, we have six initiative areas currently. We look at water quality, and we have a very sophisticated water quality observatory in Morro Bay to try to understand the dynamics of that system and connect that to the resource management. We've looked at some issues of habitat, both within Morro Bay and outside of Morro Bay, trying to understand what are the available habitats for different species and what are their distributions. We've looked at human access and how much human access is sustainable for particular communities like the Rocky Intertidal Community. We've tried to develop a suite of bioindicators. Is in the environment, how does that manifest itself in terms of economic outputs? So that's what we've done before. And this program was built by sitting down with stakeholders and resource managers at various agencies and municipalities and saying, where can we bring academic science to the work that you're doing, and how can we help you with the work that you're doing? And that's where these initiatives grew from. They're not pet projects of academic researchers, but we tried to turn the paradigm on its head and ask the resource managers, what can we do to help you? So we've had some great successes, and I'm not going to go into any of those. I want to move to talk about, well, what are we doing now, and what do we plan to do in the future? And to lead you into that, I need to mention the model by which we underwent the strategic planning was this Open Standards for the Practice of Conservation, which is actually a consortium of these organizations: the Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, Wildlife Conservation Society, and African Wildlife Foundation, that got together to say, hey, we're all doing similar types of work in conservation, and there's similar processes, but we kind of do things a little bit differently, but there are many similarities. Can we bring together what we do into one format that would help other groups that have similar interests apply these sorts of biodiversity and conservation and management, for us, principles? And so we went through a fairly intense effort over the last several months, working with our advisory committee, and this includes the estuary program. It includes three seats from folks on this marine interest group. So Carolyn and Rick both participated in this. We have staff from the resource agencies, the Regional Water Quality Control Board, Fish and Game, state parks, so on and so forth. We try to bring together all of the relevant agencies and stakeholders to manage this program. And we brought these people together, which I think is for a fairly unique planning process in conservation, to actually develop what I consider to be an ecosystem plan. So let's bring this integrated group stop since then to actually formalize this strategic plan, sitting down with smaller working groups to say, are these strategies going to work? And I'll go into a little bit of that, but that would be far too lengthy for us to do that, but I want to give you a broad overview. So here's the basic process that we went through as this group. There's about 30, 35 people that participated in this, including even folks from both of the ports, Port San Luis and the Harbor District in Morro Bay, and then Janice Peters even participated with us for one day, which was nice to have her there. And this is what we did. We collectively developed a vision for our ecosystem. This group then identified a series of conservation targets. That is, these are the things that we're concerned about in this community. We explored and developed all of the factors that influence those targets. So what kinds of factors impact the targets that we're concerned about? And then we developed a series of strategies to mitigate the factors. And so if there are issues that cause land-based pollution, we developed a series of probably 30 strategies for how we would mitigate those factors. And then we developed detailed plans of action for a subset of those strategies that were then ranked by this entire group as the areas in which SLOSI should function. And they ranked these strategies by how feasible they were, how important they were, and how well they fit with SLOSI as an organization. And so I'm going to go through just a few things really quickly. So the vision that this group came up with is a healthy, resilient coastal ecosystem that provides for thriving and interacting populations of plant, animal, and human communities. And I think it's really important to emphasize here this connection to human communities that the group takes a explicit sort of stance on, that we're really thinking about people here and how they interact with the plant and animal communities. So then we developed a scope. That is, what area are we going to think? Shows the coastal watersheds there. There are about 42 of them. And then the area on the open coast. And we also picked a depth of, the group picked a depth of 100 fathoms. So this is an ecological parameter. And so on the south, Point Conception, this is really an ecological break because it's the break between two biogeographic provinces, one to the south and one to the north. I mentioned the ecological connection certainly between the watershed, so that's another ecological boundary, and then 100 fathoms is an ecological boundary. And then Point Lopez is in fact a regulatory boundary. There's no clear break as you go up the coast, but people and Fish and Game said, well, this is a region where there is some a framework for setting regulation. Fish and Game thinks about this region from Point Lopez to Point Conception as a regulatory unit. And so that's important for some of the goals and strategies as we move forward, having that particular unit. All right, so after the scope was defined, we went in and said, okay, well, what do we care about within this scope? What are the conservation targets? And I'm going to move through these very quickly. The group said watersheds, estuarine systems, shoreline habitats, sandy shoreline, dunes, and then, of course, rocky intertidal areas as well as sandy beaches, nearshore subtidal, so this is going to include you know, kelp forests, sandy bottom areas, a series of iconic species. People were coming up with, oh, well, I care about this species and that species and so on and so forth. So we lumped all of those species into this category, iconic species, which includes numerous birds and such. Marine invertebrates is another area where people felt that biodiversity and conservation was important. And then finfish as well, and that should be one word, I have to change that. Finfish as well as a species-specific target. And then finally, we really pushed the group that we were fortunate to work with, which was the Foundations of Success, or a firm that is really focused on implementing this particular process with groups, to allow us to include a very non-traditional conservation target, and that is our working bays and port systems in the marine economy. This is a human target, and so not typical of conservation groups, but we felt very important, and there's clear support for it in our group. So after we had the conservation targets developed, as I said, the group went through and identified factors that influence these targets. And I'm going to show you a figure that is going to scare you a little bit. But it's okay. You're not supposed to get anything from this exam. On the right here, this area in the green are all of our conservation. And I also made it blurry so that you couldn't read it. Isn't that nice of me? These are all of our conservation targets, all the way up here from watersheds down to the working bays and ports. These pink boxes are the direct factors. It's not important. They say things like development, land-based pollution. There's fishing here, lack of enough dredging, so on and so forth. Invasive species. We even have global climate change in there. These are all of the things that are impacting, or what we think are the most significant impacts on these targets. And you can see this spaghetti of factors and all of these arrows. These are the cumulative impacts on these targets. And that's what when we say ecosystem-based management, you need to be thinking about cumulative impacts. Out here in this area, you're not supposed to read these boxes, but all of these yellow ones are indirect factors. And so if you were to take a look at, you know, some of these indirect factors, you would see that something that influences, for instance, invasive species is an indirect factor is people moving around in boats that have organisms attached to their boat bottoms. And when they go from one port to another, they transport species. Well, why do people move around in boats? And so on and so forth. You can build this model out to say, here are all the things that influence these direct factors. That allows you to basically say, okay, here's my model of the world. This is the way the world operates. This is not my model. This is the group, right? This is the whole group that built this. These are the factors that are influencing our conservation targets. If we want to make a difference, we have to operate out here. And so that's where our strategies come in. This is where these little yellow hexagons are the series of strategies where we're going to impact one of these boxes to impact causally through these boxes and then eventually get to our conservation target. And so I'm not going to show you those except by a list here. These were out of probably 30 strategies that got winnowed down and then ranked by the group. And here they are. They are to address key pollutant sources and impacts, demonstrate regional fisheries management, guide appropriate levels of human access, identify, detect, and control marine invasives, inform decision-making for a diversified marine economy. You can just keep on burrowing down, and that's what my life has been about. I can burrow down even further. Each of these strategies has an entire results chain. And I'll show you one of these, again, not to get into the details, because I just don't think that's appropriate for us. But I want you to appreciate the amount of work that's gone into this by the group. Each of these strategies has a results chain where if this is the strategy to develop a regional fishing model, we ultimately think it's going to lead to improvement of these conservation targets. We basically have a theory of change. That is, if we do this, then these things are going to follow and ultimately lead to our desired outcome. And so the group developed these strategies for each of these action items. And we have this as well as for each of these. So this is the one for key pollutants and so on and so forth. I don't think it's good for us to go over that. I want to stay at this level and just assure you that not only are those actions and activities developed, which include a lot of science, basic science, but also some policy efforts, information exchange with resource managers. It includes a lot more than just science, which is what SLOSI has always been about. But what we're doing with each of these is sitting down with each strategy. So we were with the Water Board staff 3 weeks ago with a strategy saying, all right, you guys helped develop this. Here's what we plan to do. Does this work? Are you on board? Because we're going to put this into our proposal. And this is where your element is. This is where our element is. This is going to work out. So we're vetting each of these results chains with the appropriate collection of agencies and stakeholders. We likewise have started to vet the demonstrating regional fisheries management. We had a meeting with Rick and Carolyn and the Nature Conservancy just last week.
And fishermen
there as well. And we're vetting that strategy. And so our process is what we've been doing all along. It's just a little more explicit now, is to vet all of these strategies so that we can assure as best as we can that what we're going to do is going to lead to a result. And so I want to stop there and entertain comments from the Marine Interest Group. Maybe there are some comments from people who participated in this process, because some of the people were actually dredged through a lot of these meetings and continues to do so.
Rick or Carolyn or Deborah or you were the ones that were...
I thought it was very transformational. It's the first time I was in a group that move from adversarial stances to really looking at potential collaborative movement forward and putting a plan together that was going to not let everybody win a little bit for their side, but was actually going to win for everyone. And I think that that was the transformational nature of it. And I'm really happy to hear that all of this is now being vetted, because so much of it really is grounded in having agencies buy in. So I'm really happy to hear that that validity, that layer of credibility, has been laid on top of that. But I think the interaction itself and the plan was amazing for that quality.
Carolyn or Rick, any comment you wanted to offer?
Well, I think the experience of developing this process demonstrates that a successful plan does take time, and there is no shortcut. You have to work through the entire process. And it's something that I have never had the opportunity to do before, to start from a great diversity of interests and work toward common goals and strategies. I'm wondering, Dean, what is our timeline now? When are you going to be needing the support, and how would you like to get it?
Okay, it's on. The timeline is upon us. The first draft of the proposal went in 2 days ago, but it is going to be, there's a sort of a series of iterations of the draft between one of the funding agencies and SLOCI. So we need to line up. I think the most immediate date to think about is August 27th as the time when our proposal is going to be sent out for peer review. I think that what's going to happen is when we actually finish the formal strategic plan, we will post that.
Okay.
And so
that
will, I would be more comfortable with the finalized and formal strategic plan, which we're still working through.
Okay, that's good.
And not a proposal.
When would that be available, roughly, do you think?
Again, the 27th is when we need to have that absolutely finalized.
So in about a month or five weeks, the strategic plan will be available. You'll certainly make that available to the MIG members, and it'll be up on the SLOCI website.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble sharing all this information. I'm having trouble sharing it.
I have trouble sharing it too. So,
I think that what we can do is you know, Dina, I can talk with you about way we can maybe. I think what you're talking about is how do you come up with like a 2-page executive summary, or something that's.
I don't think you can, considering that little spaghetti system that we have going there. But something that
we're gonna.
Something that can be presented.
Something short of me running around to every single entity and presenting.
I was going to ask.
I can see you. Like, I saw the sparkle in your eye there.
I'm having trouble doing that.
Yeah.
So there's
going to
be some of that. I'm going to
know that there's a need for some kind of summary and shareable.
A communication tool.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. Good. So I think the short answer to your question about support and so on would be that if the MIG chose to express itself about this, tonight's meeting would be the time, because the next meeting is October 23rd, which is after this would all be submitted. And then, you know, relative to other meetings or other groups like your Harbor District Board or whatever that wanted to express itself individually, you know, that would be something that, you know, prior to mid-August would be really timely to get those letters of support in, and those really make a difference. Those are an explicit part of when the Ocean Protection Council in the state and others go about their review of these things. That's something, their first thing they ask. In fact, it's the first thing they asked us when we were sharing some of this with them was, you know, whom have you talked with? Who's on board?
Right.
What are people saying about this? You know, the fishermen understanding this? Are they behind this on the initiatives that relate to them? You know, if you talk with the water board, you know, who's behind all this? And so gathering that and formalizing that involvement and expression, those expressions of support are going to be very important in it. And then we'll get a draft out to you to review so that you can see if that's in accord with what you think would be appropriate. So maybe, PJ, do you want to sort of poll folk, your colleagues, and see their intent here? And
sure. I'm very much in support of the Marine Interest Group writing a letter of support for Slow Seas strategic plan. I think the plan has presented the initiatives and the greater thematic issues that you have presented are all very laudable, and they're all in keeping with the kind of thing that I think this group, as a collaborative working group on these issues, could come to consensus about. However, that being said, there may be people who don't agree with that, so I'd be more than happy for us to go around.
Dean, could you roll up the six strategies there, just so people could look at it, and maybe you'd like to entertain some questions that people might have, because those are just phrases, and for those that weren't actively involved, they may very well have some questions.
I'm trying to get that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, any questions, comments about the different items? Mary?
Can you elaborate on climate change effects and prioritize local actions?
Yeah, I can elaborate on that. This is a brand new initiative for Slow Sea. It was actually one that came up. We started thinking about this and reflecting on it a little more after the group prioritized everything, and it wasn't a strategy that was clearly articulated during the time, but is very important. And the thing that we were having trouble wrapping our head around was, how can a local group in a place that's thinking about that little chunk of the coastline really make an effect in terms of climate change? And what we came to the conclusion that what we might be able to do is think about how climate change is going to try to use some tools to figure out how climate change is going to impact us locally, and then provide that information to people who are going to have to react to that within the agencies and the government. And so this is really actually focused on, based on the tools that we have, because this is all going to be models, the tools that we have, this is going to be primarily within one of the things that you can do with this model is say, well, what happens in 50 years when sea level has come up this much or rainfall has increased this much? And you can model, the idea is that we'll be able to model how the physical environment is going to change in that area. And then if you have that information, I was just talking with a prospective master's student today, if you have that information and you know something about the biology of the organisms that live there, you can start to make some predictions about how the biology might shift in response to those kinds of changes. And so it's really going to be about exploring potential scenarios and then communicating that information.
Questions about other initiatives that are identified there, things that might be unclear or that you'd like to learn some more about what's in mind. Michael.
Just real quick, I need a microphone.
Yeah.
Does this work?
Sure. Just push up.
Not
on
now.
Push up on the button.
There.
Okay.
There
you go. There you go. So I guess I think one of the first reactions someone would have to looking at this list of strategies is how ambitious it is, and so. I kind of wonder what's kind of the implementation plan. I'm sure it's the way that you guys have done so much outreach with so many partners. I'm sure it includes partners, but right. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about sort of the implementation of each strategy as a whole, an aggregate, just kind of how you would work with other groups, et cetera, to carry
Dean,
out.
Dean, do you want to put up the regional fisheries management one, and I could walk through that if that's helpful, or you can?
No, yeah, Don's been really active in the regional fisheries management results chain, and he's been talking with folks like Sankey Masterup and people at the Coastal Conservancy about this particular strategy, as well as you guys. And so This would provide an example.
This is an example, just one of the six, but it'd give you a feeling for that if you're wondering.
The pollutants one I can throw up there as well.
Yeah, which would you prefer, the pollutant one or the regional fisheries management one? You pick.
It's going to be hard to use this as a communication tool, as you've already talked about, especially for those people at home.
Question that we have now, because in the data poor conditions that we're at, the amount of catch that's allowed is severely restricted because of the uncertainty about the stocks that are available. That and other factors results in a fishing season that is very constrained, which makes it hard for operators to keep their ice, their processing, their infrastructure for fuel, et cetera, going on a year-round basis. It's very fragile. So what does that mean? Well, we need to figure out then what sort of information is going to be necessary to get better stock assessments, to get a sense about how to manage fisheries as a portfolio rather than single species, so that there's a way to be able to create that kind of sustainable fishing environment and fishing opportunities. Well, what's it going to take to do that? Well, learn from the stock assessment people that make the decisions about all that it requires really a long-term data set. Okay? Well, that's really what the Collaborative Fisheries Research Project has been doing, and Leslie Lombach is going to talk about that in just a moment. But we've learned from that, well, that takes, an explicit understanding with the Department of Fish and Game and the Pacific Fisheries Management Council about what data they need, how the data will be used, so that we come up with the data that they can actually apply and that it'll be recognized and useful. Well, in order to do that, there really has to be some memorandum of understanding or some explicit agreement that's there to do that, because otherwise they tend to change who writes the stock assessments year to year, and it's like trying to chase a noodle. So that's going to require, also commitments from people that there be funding sources to sustain that data collection, so we don't have, as has happened in the past with the Department of Fish and Game, where they get a whole bunch of data but then no money to analyze it, or they get a start of data but not enough to carry it forward or whatever, so we have to have that figured out. So that's really, and to get that going, we really have to have the kind of policy support from elected officials, from the Ocean Protection Council, from others that can help energize the interest and support to make that happen. So that's how this results chain came about, was we really started with what's the end objective, and then we kind of worked back to figure out, okay, how do we get there, and then how do we start? And so we're working, quite honestly, right now in the first box, doing webinars with the Ocean Protection Coast. If any place on the West Coast is able to do this, we're the place, because we have the years of collaborative research. We've got the exempt fishing permit activity that TNC and the local fishermen are doing. We've got slow sea. We've got the building blocks that, frankly, nowhere else has. So that's prompted the idea that, hey, this makes sense to go for something like this. So this is an example. Each of the others has a similar thing. The pollutants in the bay and the critical problems of that and the kind of things that you've heard from Lars Tomanak about, some of the tumors identified in certain fish species and so on, is creating a real red flag that, hey, this is a big problem. We got to look at it. So similarly, we did that and worked back a chain with the pollutants in the bay to figure out, okay, how can that be impacted? What information is needed? How do we pull people together? How do we get the Regional Water Quality Control Board on tap? So that's how all of these are worked out. And all of them have basically that same level of development and detail to give you sort of a feeling for how this got generated. Does that help? Does that give a little more concreteness to, and a little sense of, is this a pipe dream or is this real? We're doing our best to sort of push the parameters on this and make sure we're understanding the practicality of it and asking people, hey, do you see this happening? We're asking Liz Clark, who's with NOAA Fisheries and the key science advisor for all of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, do you see this working? Whom do we need to talk with in the Pacific Fisheries Management Council to understand what the policy level support would be for doing this? So that's all part of the chain. Dave.
This looks like a rather convoluted and difficult subject to dig through. I'm just wondering if the MIG needs anything more than just a feel for it, like we're getting now, without having to immerse or dig down into all of the details of it in order to support it. I think from PJ was saying, what we needed to do is put together a letter, a document from this organization saying we strongly endorse the progress that's been made. We want to see it continue, and we would like to support any effort there is to continue to fund it. But I don't think we need to immerse ourselves into the details of it every
plan process, And, if we want to go on to saying the process using extensive input from agencies, stakeholders, researchers, businesses, organizations, et cetera, I mean, we could flesh it out. But I think unless there is some other input that people don't support that, I think on a larger level we could say that we support their strategic ecosystem management plan process. And
just
I
show of hands,
right?
We'd probably do it for what we want to do.
Right.
Does anybody object?
Oh, you're starting to raise your hand.
Well, okay. I think what Dave says is right, too. And it'd be good to get a drop out. It's soon when you're going to be submitting.
Yeah.
What's that? You're going to be submitting. Yes.
I just have one question about it. When the MIG started, it was a great concern about local control of various things. Because is this, in a bizarre way, through the reverse, getting at that by saying, here's what we want in our backyard, and how can we get it there? And then we go. It sounds like the various agencies that maybe in the past at the state level have been missing or made decisions that weren't right for this area because they were, like, I'm just thinking with fishing restrictions where it's statewide or whatever, that is this actually, though it looks like a bureaucratic nightmare, it isn't, because you start with how you want things at home. And then you back up.
And you work it back.
So even though it may look that way, it's not, because its origins were, we want things a certain way, we want it this way, and the way to get it that way is to get everybody that's above us, non-local, doing things or figuring us in, and not canceling each other out. Is that a fair assessment or not?
Yeah, if I understand the assessment correctly, it is a fair assessment that what we're trying to do, I think, is especially, well, not all of the initiatives are trying to do that, but certainly the regional fisheries management is trying to say, well, we've listened to what the community has said, we've looked at data that says, this place is a different part of the coast, and it's also what the Pew Oceans Commission is saying and the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy. They're all talking about
a process to them by which they can implement things that they have promised to do.
Yes, that's the opportunity here.
Yep.
And that's the interest, that's the reason why the agencies are interested in this, because they see this as a way to pursue a mandate that they've not been able to figure out how to do.
Okay. And does that include the Magnuson-Stevenson Act as well?
So, what's the pleasure of the working committee? What would you like to do on this one?
Well, why don't we just all raise our hands and say yes?
Okay. So, PJ, do you want to work with me? Maybe you and Dave can work together, and I can coordinate with you, and we'll then get something out to the working committee as a draft that they can
I'd
take
be happy
a look
to do that.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. So, we have a couple other brief items about the opportunities. One of the opportunities within this, the opportunities for citizen scientists to go out and fish for the answers to the questions of, do MPAs work? What are the stocks of fish like in the area? And there's a very concrete opportunity to do that, which, Dean, do you want to introduce Leslie?
Yeah, I'm just trying to pull it up. I can't, this multitasking here.
Oh, okay, then I'll introduce Leslie.
Get it up and also...
Leslie is entering her second year of the Collaborative Fisheries Research Program, and she's going to talk about what the opportunities are for people locally to be out fishing.
Up and, here.
And also to look for fish that have tags on them so that they we can get the information about fish that have been previously caught.
Right. So I would say that this is a sort of a more localized in-state waters effort that's related to the Marine Life Protection Act. And so this is specifically monitoring the MPA. So, Leslie.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Dean. And thank you to all you folks for supporting our project and for hearing just a quick little presentation about our first season of our MPA monitoring. This is a hook and line recreational portion of the project. And we, for our first season, looked at the Pointe Bouchon MPA. MPA, we're working in partnership with Moss Landing Marine Labs, so that is fundamental to this project. And up there, they are looking at Año Nuevo and Point Lobos MPAs. So in total, we got to work with 174 volunteer anglers, and these are recreational people. Quite a few have commercial experience as well. So we worked with, here in this area, we worked with Verges Sport Fishing and Patriot, and we got to run 6 trips out of each of those landings, and we caught a lot of fish with them. In the Pointe Bouchon MPA and reference sites combined, we caught a total of almost 2,500 fish and tagged most of those looking at all 3 of the MPAs. We caught almost 8,000 fish. So I threw up just a couple of preliminary graphs here. The analyses are still in the works, and there's a lot of work to be done to be able to talk more about the results even for the first season, which hopefully is the first of many seasons to happen. The graph on the left is just our top 5 species of total of 27 species caught throughout that season, which says black rockfish, blue gopher, olive and yellowtail rockfish. And that is pretty small on the y-axis, but it's catch per unit effort. Do I have to do that? I don't really want to. Y-axis on the upper left graph, catch per unit effort. So that's fishes caught per angler per hour. So we caught a lot of gopher rockfish. We fished just to a maximum of 120 feet. And
what do the different colors mean?
Okay. So comparing in the green, that those are the MPA catch per unit efforts, and in the pink, those were our reference sites, which the reference site lies a half mile north of that Pointe Bouchon MPA. And then as a total of all species catch per unit effort, again, the average fish is caught per September 21st. So obviously we're creating our baseline data right now, and hopefully we'll have a very long data set to be able to say more about this. So that was 2007. Now we're moving on to our season part 2 here in 2008, and we were so fortunate to get to double our trips. Dean worked so hard along with a variety of other folks to get us even more funding to add on the Piedras Blancas MPA. And we just finished our first week of sampling at our third trip today, and Piedras Blancas is pretty fun up there. And so to recruit our volunteers, I got a little help. Well, yes, we do get to bring out a variety of good folks. Don has come out with us. Variety of folks. Bruce Keogh, that was up, and his daughter were out with us. Monday, even Dean comes out with us, you know, to volunteer fish. And folks only have to be 14 years old and have some sort of saltwater fishing experience. And I've just had this inundation of volunteers after David Sneed was so nice to write an article for us a week and a half ago or so. And then I also find volunteers posting on fishreports.net and just trying to get the word around. So at the moment, my volunteer lists are looking really good, quite full. So this is our schedule for the summer, and so if the community is interested in coming out, there are still availabilities to come and fish for us and be a part of this research. September especially could use help, but a lot of those days just got really filled up. And I'm the contact person for that. Office number, the email address. Yeah, we usually have a good time out there. Also, yeah, it was a storm out there today, but sometimes it's fun.
Cool. So all this is catch and release. The fish are tagged and they're released. And so we certainly encourage people who catch a fish that has been tagged to
change. That was the first year. There's no time for an effect. And so we can already see that the habitat in Bouchon is probably a better fish habitat than it is up north a little ways where our reference site is. But that's not important. What's important is how those things change over time. And so we don't look at absolute differences on day one because they're different places. It's over time do we see differences in what happens inside and outside of the marine protected area. So I just wanted to clarify that for the audience.
Ray, did you have a question? Comment?
Yeah, I had a technical question about being a volunteer. Do you need a fishing license?
No, we have our collective.
Oh, could you go to the microphone, please, so they can...
I can answer it. If just that the answer is no, right? We have a collecting permit so that we can get in and tag.
And all the fish are released, so no one is taking fish home. Any other questions or comments? It's a great opportunity to get out there. It's a wonderful way to learn. I mean, I've fished before, but going out with the scientists and having them tell you, you know, hey, this fish is this length, it's probably this old, and this is its habitat, and seeing the different things that come out of it, it's a great learning experience. It's a great opportunity to appreciate the resource and add to the information. So if you're at all interested, I encourage you on the working committee and also out in the public to go on out and try it out. I know that we've been fortunate to have great anglers out there and helping us all to learn about this. And be sure you look for those tags. Those tags are very important. Okay. We're coming towards the wrap-up here. I think the final item that's important to cover today are the topics for the next meeting. The Marine Interest Group is going to meet next October 23rd in this location, 6 to 9 p.m. That's on your agenda. And what I'd like to do is to take a couple minutes and just get suggestions from you about things that you would like to propose for that agenda, and then we'll quickly see if there's some congruence on those topics and be able to move forward. I know there are a couple things that were discussed earlier, but let's kind of get them all on a list here and see what you think. So who's Dave?
I would like to stay right in touch with Dean on an update on the progress that's been made in the interval between this meeting and the next for how it's moving along. I think that's our primary interest at this point, is the success of this group.
But the plastics initiative, did you say?
I don't know if this is something that they're thinking about doing a countywide ban or at the county level. But that would be a great educational piece if it's coming up in March to start getting the information out to the public as well as ourselves.
Okay. Other topics of interest?
If you don't mind, I'm writing right on the exact same topic, to have Jill Falcone as a guest speaker, or Mark Hutchinson, because he's also working on the plastics ban, and the fact, I think they're trying to implement March 2008. I know Mark has expressed to me personally that the more public support that is visible before the ban, the better the success will be. And it seems like a huge, it's almost like the no smoking at the bar type of something our county is doing.
The intent
is a big
behind
deal.
It, the implications, how it's going to work, and getting more education.
Right. And so I would like to, and I'll even take it upon myself. I know that the Terra Foundation and the Surfrider are interested in doing education outreach on plastics. So hopefully other we could have more people at the meeting in October to for the presentation.
Okay, good. Rick?
So I guess I got two. We have an offer. I think I forwarded a copy of a poll that was done on Coastal Attitudes, and the representative of the Alliance Communities for Sustainable Fisheries in Monterey has offered to come down in October and make a presentation on that poll that they did on coastal attitudes about fresh seafood. And then the second one would be the oyster, maybe just a presentation on oyster mariculture activities in the bay so we can just learn more about it. I don't think we've done that before.
No, where are they? What do they do? How does that work?
Yeah, how are they regulated?
It might also be interesting, I don't know, Dean, if you'd have something to offer along those lines of, you know, how you're trying to monitor some of the issues, some of the conditions that are significant for the oyster cultures, you know, the dissolved oxygen and all this, you know, sort of what you're seeing. There might be some evolution of that data up from SLOSI that could inform some of these things.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I certainly...
Yeah, I certainly think there's probably some data there that could inform those, but I don't... I'm not sure that that would be something we want to take up.
Paper works for the one of the big, or what the only, I guess, is it the oyster, the Back Bay, too? Yeah. And I see him, the last 3 months or 4 months, all I saw him doing was coming home and checking oysters on his truck bed and checking them to see if they could start actually open up for business again. And that was because of water quality. You know, and so it's every, you know, I just was reminded every day, and he was very interested in wanting to take a tour of the Men's Colony sewage treatment plant with Surfrider had started to get together. So
the issue is that what drives, my understanding, what drives the closures is fecal coliform bacteria. Yeah. That's not what we're monitoring, right? We don't have any monitoring on bacterial levels as part of our SLOSI work. It's all dissolved oxygen, sediment, temperature, nitrates, so on and so forth. And so it's not at all bacteria. And so that's, we're not going to be able to comment on that necessarily at this point.
Okay.
I have a quick question for Dean. Is there any crosstalk between all the different groups that are doing water quality monitoring, like California Department of Health Services and what you're doing and what the Morro Bay National Estuary Program is doing? Is there?
Yeah, there is.
Okay.
It's, in fact, that's even getting explored more explicitly in this next round of SLOSI.
Great. I think the more that can be integrated, it's sort of like Simon with the integrated network of the research. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other, not that you need more topics, but any others that you want to add for consideration that we can go through and figure out which of these you'd like to prioritize for next time? Any other topics? Okay. So, why don't we just get us what's a quick and easy way? Maybe a quick show of hands on, you know, pick three out of these that you think would be you most like to hit. And let's just see where we are.
Well, I would suggest we can do all four because progress on SLOSI, I mean,
it's going to be a brief update.
Yeah, it would be a brief update. You
so
just
maybe
want to know
maybe
what's happened.
Maybe and some
that,
of these.
That
so this could be brief.
Yeah.
Okay. And anyone have a sense from your talks with Jill? Did you have a sense of what that discussion might entail? And what we need to include there?
What we could do,
Mary,
is,
what you're thinking
of? I could talk to her more, or you could talk to either one of them.
PJ? Okay. And for my purposes, who will be my coordination point? Whom should I check in with? This? Just see. Matt, you going to do that? Thank you. Okay. On the coastal attitudes and what people are looking for, and that would be Steve coming down from Monterey, right? And you've checked with him, and the date can work, so he's...
It seemed like it's kind of far ahead, but he said...
Yes.
Okay.
It's 9:10.
All right. And we'd probably load that one at the start because he's coming a long ways in the sessions. And on the oysters and the mariculture, this is what, to kind of get an overview of what they do, what are the issues they're confronting, what's happening, and so on and so forth. Who has energy or interest around helping to organize?
Dan's not here. Let's put that on Dan. He hosted the meeting today. If he won't do it, I'll take it. You make me back up.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Dan's a good
old boy.
Dan.
Okay.
Can I ask one, just real quick question?
Sure.
Dean, not to put you on the spot, but do you know when, and this is one of my pet things we talk about often, in the real world, when do you see any of this research moving into the deeper waters where there's more commercially important species that would means a lot to the fleet? Is it realistic to believe that in my lifetime, or in the next 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, 15 years?
You seem
years?
Like a pretty healthy guy, so...
Well, I don't know. When can we see some of this nearshore work?
Right.
Not exactly, because it can't be done right. Exactly like you're doing, but when can we realistically see that happening where we can really look at stock assessments on deeper species of rockfish?
Well, I think if this... I'm just telling you what I think here, so take it for what it's worth. But I think that if this regional fisheries demo project moves forward, that there's going to be a lot higher likelihood of finding our way out there. Right now, the issue is we have to be creative about where the money's coming from, and the funding, which ultimately, even in concept, if you want to do more, the funding actually drives what you can do. And all of the funding we're able to get is associated with the marine protected areas. And so that's necessarily in state waters. But, you know, as we started entering into conversations with other people it about this strategy, you start to see where if there was funding and...
Right. I know, and I'm sensitive to that.
In talking with the federal authorities, they're having a bit of a struggle to figure out how to do regional management. They only have single species framework. And that's locked them into the sort of mechanism that they have. They do have a new thing, which is now ecosystem management plans that they can come up with. But they've never done one, but they're very excited that's how we're looking at things, and so there may be an opportunity for them to think about doing that here. But I just have to be candid that that's new terrain for them, and they're having to, you know, figure out how to approach it. But maybe that's an opportunity for us. So, with that said, I think we're about to finish up. Any closing comment anyone would like to make? I really appreciate everyone's work, interest, activity. October 23rd, we'll be back. We'll be in touch with you before then about some of these other plans and letters and things that need to go out and how to get access information to keep up to date. Carolyn, you have a closing comment?
Yeah, I would. I have such a feeling of satisfaction as we see some real practical application for so many of the areas of interest and initiatives that MIG has initiated. A great deal of satisfaction in the way it's developing.
Thank you all for making it happen.